Imagine walking into a really high-end art gallery, right?
I can picture it.
You are standing there and you're just staring at this incredibly beautiful, totally serene watercolor of a sunset over the water. The light is perfectly captured. It is just so peaceful. But then you look down, and right next to the painting, instead of that little white card with like a title and a price tag, there is a sprawling, aggressive essay. Yeah, an essay telling you that the beautiful water you are admiring is actually the site of a mass grave.
I mean, that just completely shatters the illusion, doesn't it?
Completely.
And, well, it aggressively violates what is arguably the most sacred, unwritten golden rule of the fine art world,
Which is.
the absolute expectation that an artwork must speak entirely for itself. I mean, the artist is supposed to paint the canvas, step back, and just maintain this tomb-like silence.
Right, yeah, the painting is supposed to be this empty mirror where you, as the viewer, project your own feelings. If the creator steps in and tells you exactly what a brushstroke means, it is treated as this massive intrusion by the elite gallery crowd.
Very much so.
But for this deep dive, we are looking at the archives of a creator who takes that elitist golden rule, gleefully shatters it into a million pieces, and just sweeps it out the door. We are diving into the world of Jairo Duke.
He is such a fascinating figure, a 68-year-old, entirely self-taught Colombian artist.
Totally self-taught.
And the mission for us today is to dissect his incredibly unique, multi-layered process. We are going to examine how his highly specific physical techniques, the literal chemistry of his
The
watercolors.
chemistry is wild, by the way.
It really is. We'll get to how that chemistry and his decades of past political activism all violently collide to force viewers to confront the harsh, often overlooked realities of Colombia.
Okay, let's unpack this because his philosophy on this is pretty jarring. For Duke, context is completely non-negotiable. If the aesthetics of the watercolor alone aren't enough to convey the heavy memory of social struggles, he's going to spell it out for you in bold print.
He really is.
Which brings us to his boldest move. It's a new book and project he calls Trastio. In it, he prints these highly detailed socio-historical explanatory texts right next to the paintings.
And, you know, that choice did not go unchallenged.
Oh, definitely not.
One of the best pieces of source material we actually have for this deep dive is a full transcription from an arts and literature analysis group called Buscadores.
Right, the Buscadores group.
And this group spent time deeply analyzing his work. And it is not just an echo chamber of praise. Like, we actually get to see real-time friction in these notes.
Yeah, some of the critics in that group pushed back really hard against this text-heavy approach.
They did.
When I was reading through those transcripts, I mean, you can feel the tension in the room. The critics were essentially arguing that leaning on text is a crutch.
Like an instruction manual.
Exactly. The traditional mindset is that if the painting is technically proficient and emotionally resonant, it shouldn't need an instruction manual. To the critics, adding an essay felt like, well, like he didn't trust his own brushwork.
But Duke's defense against that critique is, honestly, what elevates the work from mere aesthetics into a profound tool for historical memory.
How so?
Well, he argues that the memory of a massacre or the reality of systemic displacement cannot be left up to the whimsical, open interpretation of a gallery patron.
Oh, I see.
If someone looks at a painting of a marginalized community and just thinks, "Oh, what a lovely use of blue," then the artwork has completely failed its subjects.
Wow,
He
yeah.
refuses to let historical trauma be watered down into just something pretty to look at.
But to really understand why he is so fiercely protective of that context and why he refuses to stay silent, we have to look at the life he lived for decades before he ever picked up a paintbrush in his 60s. This isn't a guy who spent his 20s lounging in a Parisian cafe debating color theory, you know?
Not even close. Duke spent decades operating in the literal trenches of Colombian society. He was a highly active political militant and a social leader, and he was constantly navigating the perpetual grinding economic anxiety that defines so much of the Latin American experience.
It's a heavy load to carry.
It is. But alongside that political militancy, there is another layer that is just crucial to his psychological makeup. He spent 10 full years completely immersed in the Hare Krishna movement.
Wait, really? Hare Krishna?
Yes, a full decade.
And we should probably clarify what that actually means on a day-to-day basis, because it's not just some casual spiritual interest.
No, it's intense.
It is an incredibly rigid structural dogma. Like every single aspect of your daily life is micromanaged.
Down to the minute.
Your diet is strictly controlled, your daily schedule is dictated, your chants, your rituals, everything operates within these highly unyielding boundaries.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it completely recontextualizes his late in life transition to watercolor.
Right.
Imagine spending your entire adult life operating under the incredibly rigid dogmas of both political ideology and highly structured spiritual movements.
That's a lot of rules.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So for Duke, taking up watercolor in his 60s is an act of profound psychological emancipation.
Because he is moving from systems where absolutely everything is controlled and dictated to a medium that is famous for being totally uncontrollable.
Precisely. Watercolor is inherently chaotic. I mean, it is literally the physics of water moving across a fibrous surface.
Yeah, you can't force it.
You cannot micromanage it the way you can micromanage a daily schedule in a monastery. You have to let it flow and bleed and act on its own accord. It is a massive psychological leap into fluidity.
That contrast is just mind-blowing to me. You have a man with zero formal fine arts academy training.
None.
And yet, he arrives on the scene with a conceptual framework that people with university master's degrees would absolutely envy. It becomes very clear that his art isn't just some quiet retirement hobby, you know? Yeah. It's a direct continuation of his activism, just channeled through a medium that finally allows him some personal freedom.
Right. But channeling that incredibly heavy, dense history onto a piece of paper isn't just about feeling liberated.
No.
No, it requires a highly disciplined, almost mechanical physical process. Duke actually built this entire workflow on a three-pillar framework. He calls it a triangulation between body, emotion, and spirit.
Okay, I have to stop you there and push back on this a little bit.
Go for it.
Whenever I hear a word like spirit thrown into a technical artistic workflow, my red flags instantly go up.
I get that.
It usually sounds like this fluffy, esoteric buzzword people use to mask a lack of actual technical skill. Like, oh, I didn't study perspective. The spirit just moved me to throw this paint on the wall.
It is a completely fair critique. And interestingly enough, the Busadores group had the exact same reservations when he presented that framework to them.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. But when Duke breaks it down, the term spirit is not esoteric in the slightest. It is purely functional and deeply grounded.
Okay, how so?
For him, body means the literal matter, so the chemistry of the pigments, the physical resistance of the paper. Emotion is the visceral gut reaction, the anger or profound sadness when witnessing a societal injustice.
Yeah.
But spirit, the spirit is the raw data.
Oh, like the research.
Yes, exactly. The spirit is his rigorous historical investigation. It's the journalism, the conceptual anchor of the work. There are no mystical muses floating around his studio. The spirit is the factual truth of the trauma he's documenting.
That makes so much more sense. So taking that highly grounded approach, how does he actually construct a painting? Because I know from his notes, there's a very specific six-step process.
Right. It begins with what he calls having the radar on.
Radar on.
Yeah. He is constantly consuming documentaries, observing the streets, watching the news. He's essentially building an archive of realities in his head. Step two is selecting a single reference photograph from that massive radar. And his ethics here are vital. He always explicitly credits the original photographer or documentarian.
That's important.
He never claims the raw image as his own original invention.
Which I think sets the baseline for the psychological weight of what he does next. Because step three is where the mental toll of this process really becomes apparent.
It really does.
He takes that single credited photograph and he spends a full week in silent mental digestion.
Just think about what that actually entails.
Yeah.
Imagine you're trying to process a photograph of a displaced family or the aftermath of systemic violence.
Most of us couldn't do it.
Right. Most of us scroll past images like that on our phones in 2 seconds because it's just too painful.
Yeah.
But Duke forces himself to sit with it for 7 full days.
Wow.
He analyzes the context, the expressions on the subject's faces, the historical weight of what happened the day the shutter clicked. He just marinates in it.
That sounds exhausting. And only after that grueling week does he move to step four, which is finally sketching out the composition.
Yes.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Step five is where the literal physics of his materials come into play.
The chemistry.
Exactly. He doesn't just grab any sketchbook from a craft store. He explicitly uses 640-gram French arches, cold-pressed, rough-grain paper.
And the chemistry and physical interaction of that specific paper is vital to his entire technique.
Why is it so important?
Well, Duke paints with incredibly heavy, highly saturated amounts of water and pigment. To put that in perspective, a standard piece of professional watercolor paper is usually around 300 grams.
Okay, so this is more than double the weight.
Exactly. If you tried his heavy water technique on 300-gram paper, the internal fibers would absorb the moisture unevenly. The paper would instantly buckle, warp, and curl up like a potato chip.
Nobody wants a potato chip painting.
Right, and all that carefully placed liquid would just slide into uncontrollable muddy puddles. You'd lose the whole image.
But a 640-gram paper is a totally different beast.
It is essentially structured cardboard. It acts like a highly disciplined sponge.
A discipline sponge, I like that.
It allows him to flood the surface with heavy liquid saturation, creating literal pools of water on the page. Because the internal fibers are so incredibly strong, the paper holds its structural integrity without collapsing.
That makes sense.
And this allows the heavy pigments to slowly bleed and mingle and fuse organically over time.
Which makes the final step, the actual execution, so fascinating. Because after a week of agonizing mental preparation, the physical act of painting takes him only 2 to 3 hours.
That's it. 2 to 3 hours.
The heavy lifting is already done in his mind.
Yes.
It's very much like a traditional photographic darkroom, you know? The image is exposed and developed internally for a full week, and those 3 hours with the brush are simply the mechanical act of printing the physical copy.
That is a great way to look at it.
It reminds me of an Olympic sprinter.
Oh, how so?
Well, you train for 4 grueling years every single day, building up all this kinetic energy just to run a race that lasts under 10 seconds. The speed of those 2 or 3 hours isn't because he's rushing the art. It's an explosion of immense built-up psychological pressure.
That analogy perfectly captures the tension. And we have to remember, Duke doesn't use this high-pressure technique to paint gentle, idyllic landscapes.
No, definitely not.
He uses it to force the viewer to look at Colombia's fractured reality, specifically focusing on vulnerable, marginalized communities.
And the ultimate example of this is his Ciénaga Grande series.
Yes, a very powerful series.
Visually, he paints these palafitos, which are wooden stilt houses built directly over the water. And if you just glance at them in a gallery, they look like tourist postcards.
He really do.
They're these beautiful, luminous watercolors of serene life on the water.
But that is exactly where his absolute refusal to be silent comes in, and why he demands the text be present. Next to these beautiful paintings, Duke's writing completely shatters the postcard
illusion. It just breaks it over your knee.
Yeah. He forces the viewer to confront the fact that they're looking at an ongoing ecological disaster. He documents the complete state abandonment of 5,000 families living in total isolation.
It's tragic.
And most devastatingly, he brings up the horrifying memory of the Nueva Venecia massacre in the early 2000s, where paramilitary groups murdered over 50 fishermen.
He forces you to realize that the serene, beautiful water you are admiring in the painting was very recently a literal graveyard. He
Exactly.
does this with other marginalized areas like Buenaventura and Siloe as well. And there is one specific piece that the Buscadores group analyzed deeply, a piece called Observador, which was actually exhibited at Art Boxes in Venice, Italy, in the summer of 2023.
Observador is an absolute masterpiece of his conceptual approach.
Describe it for us.
It depicts a faceless man seen from behind, sitting and looking out over the still houses of the Ciénaga at sunset. And this piece is where that 640-gram paper truly shines.
The heavy paper.
Yes. He utilizes the heavy saturation to create these incredibly warm, luminous, highly diluted washes of water and pigment for the sky. And he contrasts that ethereal glowing light with the dark, fragile, almost sinking silhouettes of the wooden houses.
But the composition has this one specific mechanical detail that is so jarring.
The pole.
Yeah, the pole. Right smack in the center of the painting, slicing through this beautiful, luminous sunset, he paints a rigid, opaque, black, vertical pole. It literally cuts the image in half.
It does.
When you look at it, it acts as a visual speed bump. You know when you're driving down a smooth, comfortable road and you hit a speed bump and you are violently forced to hit the brakes?
Right, it jolts you.
That's what this pole does to your eyes.
Yeah.
He installs it so your vision can't just smoothly glide across what he calls a complacent landscape. You have to stop, brake, and experience the visual obstacles of living in the Ciénaga.
And that visual obstacle is tied directly to the ethics of observation.
How do you mean?
Well, this raises a monumental question for any artist. How do you document severe trauma without exploiting it?
Yeah, that's tough.
By painting the central figure entirely from behind, faceless, Duke is taking a hard ethical stance against what is called the extractivism of pain.
Oh, he's making sure he doesn't turn their lived trauma into poverty porn for gallery consumption.
Precisely. He refuses to speak for the victims. He's not playing the white knight or the savior stepping in to rescue them.
Right.
By placing a faceless observer with their back to us, he is simply sitting alongside the community, demanding that we, the viewers, remember what happened there.
That is profound.
Though, true to form, Duke is his own harshest critic. In his private notes on Observador, he actually expresses regret that he didn't blur the foreground edges more.
Really? Why?
He wanted the watery environment to completely absorb the human figure, to emphasize how small we are against these massive social and ecological tides.
It shows how meticulously he connects the literal physics of the paint to the philosophy of the piece. But here is the inherent limitation with watercolor. It is undeniably beautiful for capturing quiet, isolated tragedy, like the memory of the stilt houses. But what happens when Duke needs to scream?
Wow.
When the systemic injustice he's documenting is loud, violent, and chaotic, watercolor is simply too delicate.
Exactly. Which forces him to completely abandon the fluid grace of watercolor for a technique that is fundamentally destructive.
Yeah.
When he addresses loud socio-political chaos, yeah, he pivots to a massive 36 by 48 inch acrylic on canvas called Contra Cultura. And the physical technique he employs here is called an image transfer.
I was reading his technical notes on this process, and honestly, the physical mechanics alone sound exhausting.
It is intensely physical.
He takes photographs and prints them out using heavy, dense laser ink. Then he slathers those photos with a potent acrylic gel or solvent and glues them face down onto the raw canvas.
Right.
He lets it dry completely, essentially baking the paper into the fabric. And then he takes water, and using purely manual friction with his bare hands, he violently scrubs and rips the paper pulp off the back of the photo.
It's a highly aggressive physical act. He is literally tearing the paper away, and what is left behind, permanently embedded in the canvas, is this crude, scratched, ghostly tattoo of the laser ink.
It's visceral.
It really is.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating here is how Duke uses this chaotic, distressed texture to create a composition that directly references the crowded, claustrophobic panic of Picasso's Guernica.
And we should point out here for you, the listener, this canvas is an absolute minefield of contemporary political symbols. They span the entire spectrum, from far left to far right ideologies. And just to be completely clear, our goal here isn't to validate, endorse, or debate his specific politics. We are remaining strictly impartial.
Very important point.
What's fascinating to us is strictly how he weaponizes these highly charged symbols as mechanical tools to manipulate the viewer's eye and brain.
That distinction is crucial.
Right.
Because contraculture is intentionally designed to short-circuit your expectations.
Right.
He doesn't just place symbols randomly. He juxtaposes them to create intense psychological dissonance. For example, he places heavy, violent references to the Vietnam War right alongside symbols of modern veganism.
Which forces the brain to try and reconcile those two things.
Exactly.
You are looking at historical atrocities next to an industrial slaughterhouse, and it forces you to question the invisible moral lines society draws.
Yes.
Like, why do we protect certain animals or certain populations with immense moral fervor while industrially processing or completely ignoring others?
It demands that the viewer reconcile their own moral boundaries. And he pushes it further.
What else is in there?
He pulls in the struggles of the LGBT community, depicting a really raw, unsettling image of priests using Bibles as literal physical weapons to attack a gay man.
Wow, that is intense.
It's a very blunt critique of how massive institutions can weaponize faith and dogma to enact violence. And floating amidst all this crowded, chaotic imagery, he painted the figure of Gustavo Petro.
Now, what's wild about that specific inclusion is the timeline.
Oh.
Duke painted this canvas in 2019. That was years before the massive 2021 Colombian social uprisings, and long before Petro actually ascended to the presidency.
It's almost prophetic.
He's placed in the composition as this element of looming unresolved tension. But, you know, this brings up a really critical question. And looking at the Buscadores a bit, I have to challenge the method here.
Go on.
When an artist uses symbols, this utterly blunt, like priests physically hitting people with books, cabs questioning their place in the food chain, looming politicians, doesn't the artwork lose its aesthetic value?
Some would say yes.
Doesn't it just cross the line into being a political pamphlet? It risks becoming just a megaphone that happens to have paint on it.
is the eternal risk of any overtly political art, and it's a line Duke walks very carefully. The defense for his method, and why Contra Cultura avoids falling into the trap of the pamphlet, is found in what the canvas doesn't do.
Which is what?
Well, a political pamphlet is designed to give you a slogan. It tells you exactly what to think and offers a tidy solution to a complex problem.
Right.
Duke's canvas refuses to offer any solutions.
It just presents the chaos.
Exactly. He uses the alluring, incredibly complex, ghostly texture of that ripped image transfer to draw your eye in.
Yeah.
You lean in closely because the physical technique itself is so fascinating.
Right, you get sucked into the texture.
But once you are close, once you are engaged with the texture, he hits you with absolute ethical discomfort. The goal of the piece is to completely unsettle the viewer, to leave them with unresolved tension, not to indoctrinate them with a neat political slogan.
It's an aesthetic trap.
Yes.
He lures you in with the mastery of his materials and then drops a philosophical anvil on your head.
That's a perfect way to put it.
And honestly, synthesizing this whole journey, it is remarkable to step back and look at the sheer scope of what he does.
It really is.
You have a process that starts with a 68-year-old man pausing a documentary on a television screen, then choosing a heavily structured 604-gram piece of French paper because the literal chemistry demands it, enduring a full week of silent, agonizing mental digestion, just sitting with the trauma of a photograph.
Just sitting with it.
And finally, executing a 3-hour high-pressure dance of water and pigment that ultimately serves as an exercise in preserving national memory.
And in doing so, Duke proves something essential about the nature of art and lived experience.
What's that?
He proves that the lack of a university degree or formal academy training doesn't prevent a brilliant mind from building a profound theoretical framework.
Not at all.
In the last third of his life, he has definitively proven that the golden rules of the elite gallery, like the rigid rule of the silent artist, exist precisely so that someone with enough heavy, gritty life experience can come along and break them.
Yeah, break them wide open.
He proved that the socio-historical context matters exactly as much as the color on the canvas.
So what does this all mean? We've looked at the chemistry of the paper, the transition from rigid activism to fluid watercolor, and the shattered rules of the art world.
A huge journey.
But I want to turn this directly to you, the listener, and give you something to chew on after you finish this deep dive.
Okay.
If you had to paint the Tristio, you know, the great transition, the moving of your own life's most monumental character-defining shift, what single reference photograph would you choose as your starting point to stare at for a week?
Oh, wow.
And more importantly, what rigid black vertical pole would you plant right in the middle of your mental landscape to force everyone else to stop, break, and truly observe it?
It's a powerful question to sit with.
Something to mull over. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.